Judd was having his breakfast when Billy came downstairs. He glanced up at the clock. It was 5:25. "What's up with thee?" Judd asked. "I'm off out nesting with Tibby and Mac." He washed the curtains open. The morning light came in as clean as water. The sun had not yet risen. Above the roofline of the house opposite, the chimney stack was silhouetted against a cloudless sky. "Just think, when we're going up to Woods, they'll be going down in cage," said Billy. "And next year they'll be coming down with me. I'll not, won't they? No, 'cause I'm not going to work down pit." "No," said Judd. "For one thing, they'll have to be able to read and write before they'll set thee on. And for another, they won't have a weedy little runt like thee." He put his jacket on and went out. By the time Billy had crossed the estate, the sun was rising behind a band of clouds low in the east. Towards the city, a pit chimney and the pit head winding gear showed above the rooftops, and at the back of the estate was a patchwork of fields giving way to a wood which stood out on a far slope, as clear as an ink blot. Billy walked round Tibby's house, looking up at the drawn curtains. He tried the kitchen door, then stepped back and whispered loudly up at the bedroom window, "Tibby! Tibby!" The curtains remained closed. He stepped close to the house and lobbed a clod of earth underhand at the bedroom window. The curtains remained closed. At Max, he used tiny pebbles, pinking them individually off the glass. He had used half a fistful before Mrs. McDowell pushed the window open and leaned out. "What do you want at this time?" "Ain't your Mac getting up? He's fast asleep." "He's a right un. It were him that planned it and all." "Well, stop shouting then." She closed the windows. Billy scrunched the pebbles round in his fist and threw them, then ran down a snicket between two houses, out into the fields, leaving the estate behind him. He reached the stile which led into the woods. Overhead, the branches webbed into a green canopy, a continuous play of light and shade with every rustle of the leaves. Hidden somewhere among the branches, a chaffinch gave out its long, undulating notes. A robin, tick, tick, tick. A pair of wrens, their loud chirrs out of all proportion to their mouse-like size. Below him, four beaks opened, and he crouched down over a thrush's nest. The four young were almost fully fledged, and they fitted the nest as snugly as a completed jigsaw. Billy stroked their backs gently with one finger, then stood up and rearranged the brambles over the nest before passing on. The wood ended at a hawthorn hedge. Beyond an orchard stood Monastery Farm, and at the side of it, the ruins and one remaining wall of the monastery. As he crawled through the hedge, a kestrel flew out of the wall and veered away across the fields beyond the farm. A speck appeared on the horizon. It held like a star, then fell and faded, died, fading and reforming. The dot magnified slowly. The hawk braked and lay on the air, looking down, primaries quivering to catch the currents, tail fanned. It hovered, then dropped vertically in short bursts until it closed its wings and stooped, a breathtaking swoop, to rise again with its prey secure in its talons. Billy watched it swoop high into a hole on the monastery wall. He noted the place carefully. He had almost reached the ruins when a little girl playing at the front of the farmhouse saw him. She ran round into the yard and returned with her father.
"Hey, what you doing?"
Billy stopped and glanced back towards the wood.
"No."
"Well, bugger off then.
Don't you know this is private property?
Can I get up to that kestrel's nest?"
"What kestrel's nest?"
Billy pointed at the monastery wall.
"There's no nest up there, so off you go."
The farmer started to walk across to the ruins.
"Go on, mister.
I've never found a hawk's nest before."
"Come on, then."
As soon as Billy reached the farmer, he pointed up at the wall, his finger steady on one spot. The farmer glanced down on him and smiled.
"It's nested here for donkey's years now."
"Have you ever been up to it?"
"I've never fancied going that high."
Billy studied the face of the wall.
"They've been going to pull it down for years," said the farmer.
"What for?"
"It's dangerous."
"If I lived here, I'd get a young'un and train it."
And how'd you go about it?
Billy held the farmer's gaze, then looked away. He concentrated on his pumps for a minute, then looked up quickly.
Do you know anyone who's kept one?
One or two, but there's always let them go because they couldn't do aught with them.
Where could you find out, then?
In books, I suppose.
I'm off then now. So long, mister.
Billy ran across the field back the way he'd come.
Got any books on orcs, missus?
The girl behind the counter looked up from sorting coloured tickets in a tray.
Are you a member?
What do you mean, a member?
You can't borrow books unless you're a member.
I only want one.
Do you live in the borough?
No, I live out on Valley Estate.
Well, that's in the borough, isn't it?
You'll have to take one of these forms home first for your father to sign. He took it and looked down at the dotted lines and blank boxes.
My dad's away.
You'll have to wait until he comes home, then.
I mean, he's left home.
Oh, I see. Well, in that case, your mother'll have to sign it.
She's at work.
There's no rush, is there?
I want a book today.
You'll just have to want, won't you?
She turned round and entered a little glass office. Billy beckoned her out.
Where's there a bookshop?
What's thou want that for when thou can't read?
Judd reached over Billy's shoulder and snatched the book out of his hands. Billy ran after him into the living room.
Giz it back! Come here!
Judd held him off, trying to read the title at arm's length as the book flapped open and shut.
A Falconer's Handbook? Where's thou got that from?
I've lent it.
Thou must be crackers.
How's thou mean?
Nicking books?
He skimmed it hard across the room. The covers flapped open, and when Billy grabbed at it, he bent and scuffled the pages back.
Anybody'd think it were a treasure that got.
It's smashing. I'm nearly halfway through already. I'm going to get a young kestrel and train it.
Train it? That couldn't train a flea.
Judd laughed out, mouth open, head back, more a roar than a laugh.
Any road? Where's I going to get a kestrel from?
I know a nest.
Where?
I'm not telling.
Judd rushed over to the settee and jumped astride Billy, pushing his face into the cushions and forcing one arm up his back in a half Nelson.
I said, where?
Get over, Judd, that's breaking my arm.
Where then?
Monastery Farm.
Judd let go and cuffed Billy's scalp as he stood up. Billy sat up, rubbing the tears from his cheeks and massaging his arm.
I'll have to see about going round with gun.
I'll tell Farmer on thee if there does. He protects them.
Don't talk wet, said Judd.
Orcs are a menace to farmers. They eat all the poultry and everything. I know. They dive down on the cows and carry em away and all.
They think they know something about it, don't they?
I know more about it than thee, any road, said Billy.
Thou near lives around them bleeding woods. It's a wonder thou don't turn into a wild man.
Judd stuffed his tongue under his bottom lip, grunting and scratching his armpits. Then he straightened up, grinning.
Billy Casper, wild man at woods. I ought to have thee in a cage. I'd make a bloody fortune.
Mrs. Casper came in from the hall, smoothing wrinkles out of her sweater. Every time she brushed her palms down the front, her breasts flubbered underneath.
You're a couple of noisy buggers, you two. What have you been making him raw for, Judd?
Well, he's nought but a big baby, and thou nought but a big bully.
Shut it, said Mum.
She stood between them, looking from one to the other, then moved across to the fireplace and looked into the mirror.
How did your horses get on today, Judd? She asked.
Not bad. Had a double up.
You'll be treating us all tonight, then, she said, and don't be coming home blind drunk again.
Why, you entertaining?
Don't be so cheeky.
Judd slipped his suit jacket on and flexed his shoulders, smiling at himself in profile through the mirror.
Some bird's gonna be lucky tonight.
He fluffed the bob at the front of his hair and walked out, whistling.
What are you going to do with yourself tonight, love?
Read my book, said Billy.
That's nice.
What's it about?
Falconry. I'm going to get a young kestrel and train it. I say, what time is it?
I've cleaned bottom at shed out ready, and I've built a little nesting box out of an orange box till 7:50.
I'm going to be late as usual. She hurried through the kitchen and banged the door, leaving the house quiet behind her. Billy opened his book, pointed to his place, and began to lick the words as his finger crept under the lines. At the first sound of footsteps on the stairs, he slipped the book under the pillow and ran across to the light switch. The footsteps were heavy, their progress punctuated by halts that suggested each time that the climb had been abandoned.
"Billy, wake up."
Judd flopped down on the bed, giggling. Billy turned Judd onto his back and took his shoes off. He worked his trouser bottoms over his heels, then pulled them over his feet and off. "I'm fed up with this bloody game. It's every Saturday night alike." Judd was asleep, snoring, mouth open. He snapped Judd's mouth shut and held his lips between his finger and thumb. Judd began to grumble in his throat. Then he tossed his head free and his eyelids fluttered.
"What's up? What's up?"
"Get back to sleep, you pig. Hog. Sow." Clawing at Judd with his right hand. "Hog." Left hand. "Sow." One strike per syllable. Billy's claw involuntarily hardened to a fist and thumped Judd smack on his ear as he turned over onto his side. Then the monster began to rumble. Billy snatched his clothes off the chair, flicked off the light as he ran past and ran downstairs. The farmhouse was in darkness. The moon illuminated the face of the wall, picking out the jut of individual stones and shading in the cracks and hollows between them. Billy selected his route, found a foothold, a handhold, and began to climb. Slowly. Hand. Foot. Hand. Foot. Never stretching. Never jerking. Always compact. Always balanced. He reached the window and hooked his left arm over the stone sill. He slapped the stone and shh-shhed at the hole at the other end of the sill. Nothing happened, so he climbed astride and hutched across to the next hole. He peered in, but there was nothing to see, so he stretched belly flop along the sill and felt into the hole, wriggling further along as his arm went further in. 5 times he felt into the hole, and each time fetched out a young hawk. Each one came out gasping, beaks open, legs peddling the air. By a process of elimination, he placed them back into the nest until he was left with only one, the one with most feathers and only a little down on its head. He lowered it into his pocket. When he reached the bottom of the wall, he opened his jacket and clucked down into the pocket. The weight at the bottom stirred. He placed one hand underneath it for support and set off back across the orchard. He started to whistle, and he whistled and hummed to himself all the way home. When Billy arrived home from his paper round, the curtains were still drawn in all the front windows, but the light was on in the living room. As he crossed the front garden, a man appeared from round the side of the house and walked up the path to the gate. Billy banged the door and walked through into the living room. His mother was standing in her underslip, a lipstick poised at her mouth.
"Oh, it's you, Billy. Haven't you gone to school yet?"
"Who's that bloke?"
His mother pressed her lips together. "That's Reg. You know Reg, don't you?" She took a cigarette packet from the mantelpiece and shook it, dropped the packet into the hearth and turned to Billy. "You haven't got a fag on you, have you, love?"
"Is that him you come home with last night?"
"Do me a favour, love, and run up to the shop for some fags. I can't. I'll be late. Go you sen. Oh, I've not time. Just tell Mr. Hardy to put it in book, and I'll pay him at weekend."
"I'm not going." They faced each other across the table, their fingers spread on the cloth, like two pianists ready to begin.
"We'll see whether you're going or not, you cheeky young bugger."
"He said I'd get stick next time."
"That's not to what you'll get if I catch you."
He whipped the kitchen door open and ran out into the garden. He was halfway down the path when his mother appeared, panting and jabbing a finger at him.
"Just you wait, lad. Just you wait till tonight."
She slipped the key under the lip of the step, then pulled the ends of her headscarf tight under her chin.
"And there's a bet of our judge to take and all."
"I'm not taking it.
You better, lad. I'm fed up of taking them. He can take them his sen.
How can he, you dozy bugger, if you don't get home in time?"
"I don't care. I'm not taking it."
She rounded the house and hurried up the path. Billy gave the path a V sign and made a farting noise with his mouth. When he heard the gate bang, he turned round and walked down the path towards the shed at the bottom of the garden. The roof and sides of the shed had been patched neatly with lengths of tarpaulin. The door had been freshly painted, and a square had been sawn out of the top half and barred vertically with clean laths. On a shelf behind the bars stood a kestrel hawk. Rufus brown, flecked breast, dark bars across her back and wings. Billy clicked his tongue and chanted softly.
"Kez, Kez, Kez, Kez."
The hawk looked at him and listened. Her fine head held high on strong shoulders, her brown eyes round and alert.
"Did you hear her, Kez? Do this, do that.
I have to do everything in this house. I'm fed up of being chased about. There's always somebody after me."
"Anderson, sir. Armitage, yes, sir. Bridges, away, sir. Casper, yes, sir. Fisher, German bite."
Mr. Crossley dug the biro point in. Too late. The black stroke skidded diagonally down the square.
"Did you say something, Casper?"
"Yes, sir. I didn't..."
"Stand up."
The boys looked up at him, grinning, lolling back on their chairs.
"It's crackers, sir. You can't help it." "Silence! Is this your feeble idea of a joke, Casper?"
"It's a shipping forecast, sir. German bite comes after Fisher. Fisher, German bite, Cromarty. I know 'em all. It just came out, sir."
"And so did you, Casper. Just came out from under a stone."
The class roared out again, tossing their heads back and scraping their chairs, banging the desk lids and thumping the backs and arms of any boy in range.
"Hymn number 175. New every morning is the love."
The scuff and tick of the turning hymn book pages was slowly drowned under a rising chorus of coughing and hawking in the hall, until Mr. Grice, furious behind the lectern, scooped up his stick and began to smack it vertically down the face. The sight and swish smack of the stick stopped the throat noises. Then a boy coughed.
"Who did that?"
Everybody looking round.
"I said, who did that?"
The teachers moved in closer, alert like a riot squad. Mr. Crossley grabbed the boy by the arm and began to yank him into the open. Grice thrust his jaw over the front of the lectern, the air whistling down his nostrils.
"McDowell! I might have known it. Get to my room, lad. We will now sing the Lord's Prayer. Eyes closed, heads bowed."
Billy closed his eyes and yawned down his nostrils into his chest.
"Casper! Casper!"
Billy opened his eyes. The rest of the school was sitting on the floor, giggling up at him. Billy dropped down as quick as a house of cards.
"Up, Casper! Up on your feet, lad!"
There was a moment's pause, then Billy rose into view again. His reappearance produced a buzz of excitement. Grice let Billy stand there, head bowed, face burning on his chest.
"You were asleep, weren't you? Well, speak up, lad."
"I don't know, sir."
"Fast asleep during the Lord's Prayer. I'll thrash you, you irreverent scoundrel. You wouldn't be tired if you'd get to bed at night instead of roaming the streets at all hours up to mischief."
"No, sir."
"Report to my room straight after assembly. Now, here are the announcements. A reminder that the youth employment officer will be in this afternoon to see the Easter leavers. I would also like to see the three members of the Smokers' Union at my room straight after assembly. Right, dismiss."
The three smokers, McDowell and Billy, stood in a loose circle in the foyer outside Grice's room. "Bringing my father up if he gives me its stick any road," said McDowell.
"What's thou always bringing the father up for? He never does aught when he comes."
"They say last time he came up, Grice gave him stick and all," said Billy.
The three smokers fell away and leaned back on the half-tiled wall to observe.
"At least I've got a father to bring up. That's more than I can say, Casper."
"Shut the gob, McDowell."
"Why? What's I going to do about it, Casper?"
They closed up, chest to chest, eye to eye, fists ready at the hips.
"Tha'd be surprised."
"Right then," said McDowell, "I'll see thee at break. Any time thou wants."
They stepped apart at footsteps approaching down the corridor. Grice strode past them and entered his room as though they weren't there.
"Come in, you reprobates!"
They all turned their heads when the door opened and Billy walked into the classroom. Mr. Farthing stopped talking and waited for him to approach.
"I've been to see Mr. Grice, sir."
"How many this time?"
"Two."
"Sting?"
"Not bad."
"Right, sit down then." He watched Billy to his place and waited for the class to settle. "Right, 4C, to continue. Fact." On the board behind him was printed Fact and Fiction. "Right, who can tell us an interesting fact about themselves?" "What about you, Casper?" Billy was bending over, inspecting his hands under the cover of the desk. He blew on them and cooled them with his tongue.
"Casper!" shouted Mr. Farthing.
Billy sat up and put his hands away. "Tell him about the hawk, Billy."
"What's this about this hawk? What is it? A stuffed one?"
The shout of laughter from the class spilled the first tears onto Billy's face and left Mr. Farthing looking about in surprise at these opposing reactions to his question.
"He's got a hawk, sir," said Tibbet. "It's a kestrel. He's crackers wi' it."
Billy turned on him.
"It's better than thee any day, Tibby."
"Now then, Billy," said Mr. Farthing, "tell me about this hawk. Where do you keep it?"
"In a shed."
"And what do you feed it on?"
"Beef, mice, birds."
"Wouldn't it be happier flying free?"
"I fly it every day. I've trained it."
Billy looked round as though daring anyone to challenge this authority.
"Trained it?" asked Mr. Farthing. "I thought you'd to be an expert to train hawks."
"Well, I did it."
"Was it difficult?"
"Course it wa."
"Well, tell me how you did it then."
"Well, you can only do aught with 'em when they're hungry. So you do all your training at feeding time. I could tell when Kez were keen. She jumped straight onto my glove as I held it towards her. So while she were feeding, I got hold of her jessies and..."
"And what are jessies, Billy?"
"The little leather straps that you fasten round its legs. You push your swivel through..."
"Whoa, whoa."
Mr. Farthing held up his hands as though Billy were galloping towards him. "You'd better come out here and give us a demonstration." Billy stood up and walked out, held his left fist out and explained the jessies and swivel that attached the hawk to his hand, how he'd got her used to being out of the shed and near other folks before he could begin her training, getting her to jump onto his glove for meat, and then flying her on the long line of the creons. Farthing wrote each new word on the board.
"Takes weeks to go through all them stages," Billy said. "You'd think you'd learned a summat and put her away feeling champion. The next time you went, you were back where you started."
He looked down at Mr. Farthing, eyes animated, cheeks flushed under a wash of smeared tears and dirt.
"You make it sound very exciting, though."
"Oh, it is, sir. But most exciting thing, when I flew a free for first time. You ought to have been there then. I were frightened to death."
Mr. Farthing turned to the class. "Do you want to hear about it?"
Chorus.
"Yes, sir."
Mr. Farthing smiled and turned back to Billy. He took his time describing his fear of losing her, the careful preparation, then the flight.
"I unclipped creons, took swivel off, and let her hop onto the fence post. There were no stopping her now. She were just standing there with her jessies on."
Billy held his left fist up and stared out of the window.
"Come on, Kez! Come on, then!"
"No happened at first. Then just when I were going to walk back to her, she came. Straight as a die, about a yard off floor. She came like lightning.
head dead still and her wings never made a sound. Then wham! Straight onto the glove, claws out, grabbing for the meat. I were that pleased I didn't know what to do with my sen. So I thought, just to prove it, I'll try her again. And she came second time just as good. Well, that were it. I'd done it. I'd trained her.
Right, you can sit down now, Farthing said, when Billy finished. That was very good. I enjoyed it, and I'm sure the class did.
Billy blushed, then walked back to his place, looking down at his feet. His return to the ranks was greeted by a splatter of applause.
Right. Facts. True stories. Now then, 4C, what do we call stories that are imaginary?
Chorus.
Fiction, sir.
All right.
I don't care what you write about as long as it's fictitious. We'll call it...
He stood up and turned to the board, writing, A tall story.
You know what a tall story is, don't you?
It's something that's too far-fetched to be true, said Jordan.
Right.
Farthing sat down to direct the scene. Billy dipped his nib right up to the metal holder. Then, balancing on the front legs of his chair, buck and head askew, he began. A tall story. One day, I woke up, and my mother said to me, Here, Billy, there's your breakfast in bed for you. There was bacon and eggs and butter and a big pot of tea. The sun was shining outside and we lived in a big house up Moor Edge. And I said, Where's our Judd? He's going in army, my mother said, and he's not coming back. But your dad's coming back instead. My dad came in carrying his case he took away with him. When I got home from school, my mother said, I'm not going to work anymore, and we all went to pictures and had ice cream at the intervals, and then we all went home and had fish and chips for our supper, and then we went to bed. At break, Billy walked round to the back of the school and crossed the strip of asphalt to the cycle shed. Lookouts were posted at either end of the shed, and in one corner a gang of boys was assembled, some smoking, some hanging around in the hope of a smoke, including McDowell.
Got out, Casper?
Billy shook his head.
Tha never has, thee. Tha just cadges all thine. Casper the Cadger, that's what they ought to call thee.
Billy crossed to the other end of the shed and looked out across the asphalt. At one side of the boiler house door were 8 dustbins in a line, and at the other side, a heap of coke. Grinning, McDowell led the line of smokers across the shed, and they took up position in the corner behind Billy.
What's up, Casper? Don't they like company?
He winked at the boys around him.
They say their mother does.
The gang began to snigger and snuggle into each other. Billy turned his back on them again.
I've heard tha's got more uncles than any kid in this city.
The shout of laughter seemed to jerk Billy round as though it had pulled him by the shoulder.
Thee, tha won't say what tha's just said to our Judd. He'd murder thee. He's not your Judd.
Tha what?
He's cock at a stake, that's all. Your Judd won't stick up for thee any road. He isn't even thee brother.
What is he then, me sister?
He's not thee right brother, me mother says. They don't even call him Casper for a start. Course he's me brother. We live in the same house, don't we? And he don't look a bit like thee. He's twice as big for a start. You know, like brothers.
Billy ran at him. The gang scattered. McDowell took a step back, lifted one knee and pushed Billy off with his foot. Billy came back at him. McDowell delivered a straight right which caught Billy smack in the chest and bounced him back onto his arse.
Get away, you little squirt, before I spit on thee and drown thee.
Billy got up, coughing and crying and rubbing his chest. He scooped up 2 handfuls of coke, then he began to throw it lump by lump. One hit McDowell in the back, another on the leg. As Billy stooped for fresh ammunition, panting and pausing for a moment's rest, McDowell ran at full speed, dived and landed full length on his back.
Fight! Fight!
boys abandoned their games and raced round to the back of the school. As more and more spectators arrived, the first arrivals were forced up the heap, and the cart was trampled backwards and levelled out across the asphalt. McDowell was now astride Billy, pinning his biceps under his knees. Enter Mr. Farthing, running. The knot slackened as boys hurried away before Farthing could reach them. He lifted McDowell off Billy and shook him like a terrier shakes a rat. 4 seconds later, McDowell's and Billy's faces were the only two in sight. "Now then, what's going off?" asked Farthing. Billy began to cry. McDowell wiped his nose along the back of one hand and looked at it. "Well, Casper?"
"It were him, sir. He started it."
"It were him," said McDowell. "He started chucking corks at me." "Shut up, both of you," said Farthing. "It's the same old tale. It's nobody's fault, and nobody started it. Just look at the mess you've made." 2 dustbins were lying on their sides, their contents spilling out, and 3 more bins were without their lids. "And just look at the state of you both." Billy's shirt buttons had burst open all down the front. Their faces were the colour of colliers. "And stop blubbering, Casper. You're not dying, lad." "He will be when I get hold of him." Mr. Farthing stepped up to McDowell and bent his knees to bring their faces level. "If you're so keen on fighting, why don't you pick on somebody your own size, eh? Eh?" Simultaneously pushing McDowell twice in the shoulder. "I'll tell my dad." "Oh, of course you will, lad. And then do you know what I'll do, McDowell? I'll tell mine." He dragged McDowell up by the lapels to keep their faces level. McDowell was now blubbering freely. "Well, what's it like to be bullied? You don't like it much, do you?" He dropped McDowell. "Now get into school." McDowell walked away, rubbing his eyes and his cheeks with his knuckles. "Now then, Casper, what's it all about? It must have been something." The skin on Billy's face tightened, pulling at his mouth and his eyes, and he began to cry again. "Why do you think it is?"
"What, sir?"
"That you're always in trouble."
"I don't know, sir. I seem to get into bother for naught. You know, for daft things like this morning and all. I just dozed off, that's all. I've been up since 6, then had to run around with papers, then run home to have a look at Ork, then run to school. Well, I mean, you'd be tired, wouldn't you, sir?"
Mr. Farthing chuckled. "I'd be exhausted. How are things at home these days?"
"All right, sir. Same as usual, I suppose."
"What about the police? Have you been in trouble with them lately?"
"No, sir. That's one of the reasons why McDowell's always picking on me. 'Cause I don't knock about with their gang anymore. It was when I got my Ork. It was summer then, you see, and he used to take it down our fields at night. Then when Dark Nights came back, I never got back in with him. I try to get older falconry books and make new jesses and all, and sometimes I go down to the shed and sit with a candle lit. I've got a little paraffin stove that I found. It makes you feel right cosy and snug sat there with wind blowing outside."
"You're a lone wolf now, then."
"I'd like to be, if only folks would leave me alone."
"Have you got a job yet?"
"No, sir. I've to see youth employment bloke this afternoon."
"What kind of job are you after?"
"I'm not bothered. Oh, it'll do me. Might be able to save up and buy a goshawk then. I've just been reading about 'em."
"This hawk of yours, I'd like to see it sometime. When do you fly it?"
"Dinner times. It gets dark too early at nights."
"Do you fly it at home?"
"Yes, sir. In fields at back of our house."
"Right then. I'll be down. That's if I may."
"Yes, sir."
Home. At dinner time, straight home. It was cold and quiet in the living room, and darkness shaded the corners. Articles of clothing littered the furniture, a nylon slip slithering over one arm of the settee. On the table, used crockery was grouped about the checked cloth, like the pieces of an abandoned game. At one end of the mantelpiece, he noticed 2 half-crowns holding down a folded slip of paper next to the clock. He dropped the coins into his jacket pocket and unfolded the betting slip. 5 shillings, double. Crackpot. Tell him he's dead. He refolded Judd's slip and stuffed it into the same pocket as the money, then left the house and shut the door behind him. The hawk was waiting for him.
As he unlocked the shed door, she screamed and pressed her face to the bars. He selected the largest piece of beef, then he eased the door open and shoved his glove through the space. The hawk jumped onto it. Billy swiftly followed his fist into the hut, secured the door behind him, and while the hawk was tearing at the fringe of beef, he attached her swivel and leash. Outside, the hawk flapped her wings and fanned her tail, her claws still gripping the glove. Billy cast her off by nudging his glove upwards, and she banked away, completed a wide circuit, then gained height rapidly while he took the lure from his bag and unwound the line from the stick. "Come on, Kez! Come on, then!" He whistled and swung the lure short-lined on a vertical plane. The hawk turned, saw it, and stooped. "Bloody hell, fire!" Mr. Farthing was tiptoeing towards him, concentrating on his passage through the grass. With his overcoat on and his trousers pinched up, he looked like a day tripper paddling at the seaside. Billy allowed him to get within 30 yards, then stopped him by raising one hand. "You'll have to stop there, sir. If you think I'm too near, I can go back to the fence." "No, you'll be all right there, as long as you stand still."
"I won't breathe."
Billy cast her off again. She wheeled away, high round the field. Billy plucked the stick from the ground and began to swing the lure. The hawk turned and stooped at it. Billy watched her as she descended, waiting for the right moment as she accelerated rapidly towards him. "Now!" He straightened his arm and lengthened the line, throwing the lure into her path and sweeping it before her in a downward arc, then twitching it up too steep for her attack, making her throw up, her impetus carrying her high into the air. She turned and stooped again. Billy presented the lure again, and again, each time smoothly before her, an inch before her, so that the next wingbeat must catch it, or the next. Working the lure like a top matador his cape, encouraging the hawk, making her stoop faster and harder, making Mr. Farthing hold his breath at each stoop and near miss. "Come on! This time, Kez! This time!" She shortened her stoop and counter-stoop, which increased the frequency of her attacks and made Billy pivot and whirl and watch, but never lose control of the lure or its pursuer. Until finally the hawk sheered away and began to ring up high over the hawthorn hedge. "Come on then, Kez! Once more, last time!" And she came, head first, wings closed, swooping down. He allowed her to take the remaining beef scrap from the lure, then took her up and attached the swivel and leash. She looked up sharply at a series of claps. Mr. Farthing was applauding softly. Billy started towards him, and they met halfway, the hawk fixing the stranger every second of their approach. "Marvellous, Casper! Brilliant! That's one of the most exciting things I've ever seen!" Billy blushed, and there was silence while they both looked at the hawk. The hawk looked back, her breasts still heaving from her exertions. "When it flies, there's something about it that makes you feel strange," said Farthing. "I think I know what you mean, sir. You mean everything seems to go dead quiet." "That's it!" His exclamation made the hawk jerk up and tense. "Steady on, sir. You'll frighten her to death." Mr. Farthing pointed two fingers to his temple and triggered his thumb. "Sorry, I forgot." The hawk roused and settled again. "It was just that you got it so right about the silence, Billy. Have you noticed how strange it sounded when I raised my voice? It was almost like shouting in a church."
"It's 'cause they're nervous, sir. You have to keep your voice down."
"No, it's more than that. It's instinctive. It's a kind of respect. I know, sir. That's why it makes me mad when I take her out and folks stop me and say, 'Is it tame? Is it ectame?' It's trained, that's all. And it's wild, and it's not bothered about anybody, not even about me, right? And that's why it's great."
Mr. Farthing moulded a fender of sand with his shoe, then slowly looked up at the hawk. "I think it's a kind of pride, and as you say, independence. It's like a satisfaction with its own beauty and prowess. It seems to look you straight in the eye and say, 'Who the hell are you, anyway?' Reminds me of that poem by Lawrence. 'If men were as much men as lizards are lizards, they'd be worth looking at.' It just seems proud to be itself." "Yes, sir.
They stood silent for a minute. Then Mr. Farthing pushed his overcoat and jacket sleeves up to look at the time.
"Good Lord, I'll give you a lift if you like. I'm in the car."
Billy blushed and shook his head.
"What's the matter?" asked Mr. Farthing. "Wouldn't it do your reputation any good to be seen travelling with a teacher?"
"Oh, it's not that, sir. I've one or two things to do first."
"Please yourself, then. But you're going to have to look sharp or you'll be late.
And thanks for the display. I really enjoyed it. You're an expert, lad."
As Billy walked up the pavement towards the betting shop, he flexed his nostrils at the smell of fish and chips blowing straight down the street. He reached the waste ground and cut diagonally across it through the rough, then paused on a mound and raised his nose. He took the 2 half-crowns out of his pocket. "Heads I take it, tails I don't." After throwing one of each, he slapped the third on his palm.
"Heads, the bugger."
When he opened the door, they all looked at him, then immediately lost interest. He took Judd's folded slip from his pocket and smoothed it out on the table.
"I say, mister, what price are these two?"
He showed them to the man who took the slip.
"Crackpot, 100-6, and tell him he's dead, that's 4-1, second favourite."
He gave the slip back to Billy.
"Have they got a chance?"
The man chuckled in his throat and shook his head.
"Nay, lad, how do I know?
Would you back 'em?" The man became serious again and picked a sheet up from the table.
"Tell him he's dead's got a good chance. I don't fancy it t'other, though. No form."
"You don't think they'll win, then?"
"How's they got 'em? Doubled?"
He lifted Billy's wrist for another look at the slip. "They're not mine, they're our Judd's."
"Well, it'll be all right if they do. I can't see it myself, though."
He shook his head and went back to his own selections. Billy screwed the slip up and threw it dart-style into the fire. The fish and chip shop was one of a parade of shops at the end of the street. F. Hartley Fish and Chips, a letter tile stretching the length of the premises. There was no one else in the shop.
"A bob's worth of chips and a fish."
Mrs. Hartley shovelled another dollop of chips into the bag. Billy exchanged his half-crown, his eyes as grateful as the 5,000, a shake of salt, a shower of vinegar, and with his change in his pocket he walked out with his portable feast. Round the corner past the co-op, to George Beale Family Butcher. "A quarter of beef." Billy dropped the meat into his inside pocket and walked along the shop fronts. The fruiterers, apples wrapped in purple papers, the hairdressers, cardboard smilers newly permed, the high-class grocer at the end. He went in, 10 embassy and a box of matches, then strolled back to school, eating his dinner. He finished it just before he reached the gates. The class was quiet, working. The teacher reading. Afternoon quiet. Darkening sky. Windows closed, top panes misting over. Billy lay his left arm along the radiator and closed his eyes. The scuffle of a turning page, a shifting chair, a whisper, a giggle, and a cough.
"Casper!"
A voice from the gods.
"Casper!"
Billy sat up white-faced, staring like somebody laid too long.
"Get on with your work, lad."
Billy dipped his pen and leaned over his book, shading his eyes with his left hand. "Divide 42,174 by 781. Billy's eyelids began to droop. His elbow began to slide along the desk, his body after it,
until the lip of the desk lid stopped his chest and made him open his eyes. He stared at the window as though listening to it. He wiped a hole in the mist and peered through it.
"Never mind what's going off out there. Get on with your work, lad."
Billy nudged the boy beside him. "Hey, up. Did they see somebody just coming up drive?" Then, from the corridor side, a distant clicking, building slowly to the ringing of steel-tipped heels, making everyone look and turn in anticipation towards the sound. Judd, looking in as he passed. The boys looked at Billy. The colour was draining from his face before their very eyes. Click, 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 still audible, steady as a clock.
"Wasn't that your illustrious brother, Casper?"
Billy was still staring at the corner where Judd had disappeared.
"I wouldn't have thought he was the type to pay his old school a visit."
The teacher started to lower his eyes to his book, then glanced up again at Billy.
"Are you all right, lad?"
Pause.
"Casper, what's the matter with you? Do you feel sick?"
"I'm all right, sir."
"Please yourself."
Billy shielded his face from the rest of the class and pretended to work. Tears mingled with the sweat bubbles on the side of his nose and sped down his cheeks. He licked them away and wiped his hand down his face. The bell rang. In the corridor, Tibbet was talking to Judd, who had his back to the notice board and one boot up against the wall. When Billy appeared, Tibbet pointed to him. Judd pushed himself up and took his hands out of his pockets. Billy looked at him, then sprinted, dodging and banging his way the full length of the corridor, past classrooms, cloakroom, and into the toilets. He ran straight across the toilets and out of the side door. The yard was deserted. Billy flattened himself to the wall. Inner door opening. Footsteps. Silence. Door clicking shut. Footsteps approaching. He got ready to run. Then bang, 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 as the cubicle doors were kicked back against the walls. He ducked down and raced, little man, up the side of the school under the classroom windows. Somewhere in school, a class was singing. Billy ran back across the asphalt and tried the boiler room door. It opened. Hot air rushed past him out of the darkness. The light switch was on the wall to his left. He felt sideways for it and clicked it on. A yard inside the door, the floor fell away in a 10-foot cliff. He clicked the light off, then stepped to the cliff edge, turned around and descended the iron ladder to the space behind the boiler, where he sat down and rested his head against the pipe. As snug as a bug, as warm as toast, as safe as houses, enclosed on two sides, with the darkness before him and the thick pipe behind. He began to nod. When Billy woke up and went out to the asphalt, there was no sound from the school. He went straight in through the toilets and into the corridor. The first classroom he looked into was empty. The second was occupied. The bell rang, and before the ringing had stopped, doors opened and boys came out into the corridor. Billy shouted and jostled with them.
"Seen 4C? Hey up, seen our class?"
He found them and rushed amongst them, smiling and rubbing shoulders.
"Where's that been, Casper?"
Billy moved alongside Tibbet.
"Have you seen our Judd?" "Hey up, where's that been? They've been looking all over for thee." "Who has?" "Grice, Pudding and everybody." "What for? I ain't done out." "Youth employment. That should have gone for the interview last lesson." "Have you seen our Judd?" "I saw him earlier on. Why?" "Did he say out?" "Just asked where there was, that's all." "What did they run away for when they saw him?" "Have you seen him since?" "What's up? Is he after thee for summat?"
When they reached their classroom, Grice was standing at the door. When he saw Billy, he batted him twice about the ears. Forehand left ear, backhand right.
"Now then, Casper, what kind of job had you in mind?"
The man at the desk had a few greased strands of hair carefully combed across the front to disguise his baldness. But they failed, like a trap covered with inadequate foliage.
"I don't know. I haven't thought about it right." "Well, you should be thinking about it. You want to start off on the right foot, don't you?"
I suppose so. He consulted Billy's record card. Offices held. Aptitudes and abilities. Right, then. Would you like to work in an office? Or would you prefer manual work?
I'd be all right working in an office, wouldn't I? I've a job to read and write.
The employment officer printed manual on the form.
Well, if you can stand a hard day's graft and you don't mind getting dirty, then there are good opportunities in mining. I'm not going down pit. Conditions have improved tremendously. I wouldn't be seen dead down pit.
Well, what do you want to do then? What hobbies have you got?
Do you like gardening? Or constructing Meccano sets? Or anything like that?
Billy shook his head slowly.
Don't you have any hobbies at all?
Billy looked at him for a moment, then stood up quickly. Can I go now? He ran straight out of school and all the way home. The shed door was open. The hawk was gone. The hasp was still locked to the door jamb, but the four screws which had secured it to the door hung useless in the metal plate. Billy rushed into the shed, rushed out again, and rushed round the back up onto the fence.
Kez! Kez!
He jumped down and ran up the path, barged into the kitchen door and bounced back when it wouldn't open.
Judd!
He felt under the step for the key, fumbled it into the lock and rushed in. The curtains were still closed in the living room.
Judd! Judd!
The echo was snubbed as he scrambled on all fours up the stairs. The bed was exactly as it had been left that morning. The pillows were buckled, the blankets rutted, and the thrown-back sheet pointed at him like a thrust-out tongue. The bookmaker's wife was just locking up when Billy reached the edge of the waste ground.
"Hey, Mrs. Rose, have you seen our Judd?" "Well, I can see you haven't, else you wouldn't be in one piece now."
"You've seen him, then?"
"Seen him? He nearly ripped place apart, that's all. I had to send for Eric Clough and Eric Street in end to prove that you never placed that bet."
"Well, has he been back?"
"They both won, you know. Crackpot got 100-8. Tell him his dad got fours. He'd have had over a tenner to draw."
Billy started to cry. Mrs. Rose shook her head.
"You won't half cop it, lad, when he gets hold of you."
A few yards along the path, and the houses had faded from dull red to dark shapes in the dusk. Only the silhouette of their roofs showed clearly against the sky. Billy pulled the lure from his inside pocket and searched in the other pocket for his handkerchief. He found it and flapped it open, then he tied it to the lure and began to swing it as he continued slowly along the path.
"Kez! Kez! Kez!"
His call was pitching up to a scream. He was panting and sobbing, but each time he shortened his grip on the cord to increase the momentum of the lure, he held his breath. He held it each time the lure travelled up, and there was silence until it fell back, unattended, and he ran forward to pick it up, crying. He started to run. He reached the stile leading into the woods and ran over it, dragging the lure behind him.
"Kez! Kez! Kez! Kez!"
He blundered on, shouting into the darkness, stumbling and falling on all fours, resting a moment with head down like a tired animal, then scrambling up and on again. Finally, the trees thinned, and through them he could see the lights of Monastery Farm. He made towards them, coming out of the trees at the hedge which skirted the cart track separating the woods from the farm. To the left of the house was an open space where the monastery wall had stood. The site was clear now, except for a few slabs of tumbled masonry which could be made out as dark shapes amongst the grass. Billy stared over the hedge across at the farm for a long time. Then he started to shiver and turned away and slowly made his way back through the woods. As he approached the estate,
the houses came up as a link of black cutouts against an orange background. Billy reached the houses and ran up the snicket into the cul-de-sac, into the orange light. Their living room light was on. He ran down the path, round to the kitchen door, and pressed the handle, paused, then allowed it to spring back as he turned away from the door and tried to see through the darkness down to the shed. Slowly he walked towards it. Slower and slower, almost stopping, then sprinting the last 10 yards. The door was still open. The shed was still empty. When Billy burst through from the kitchen, his mother and Judd were half standing at the table, startled up by the clatter which had preceded his appearance. When they saw who it was, they both sat down again.
"Where is it? What's that done with it?"
Judd glanced up at him, then back to the comic which was propped up against the sugar basin. Billy stood still, still breathing heavily, looking at Judd all the time.
"I said, where is it?"
His mother shook her head.
"Sit down, Billy, and get them wet things off before you catch your death."
Billy started to cry, big sobs that took his breath.
"What's that done to him now, Judd?"
Judd backhanded the comic straight off the table and shot up, making his mother sit up straight in her chair, and Billy stopped sobbing for a moment.
"It's his fault," said Judd. "If he'd have put that bet on like he were told, there'd have been none of this." "And didn't he?" asked Mum.
"Well, I told him before I went to work this morning."
From their own sides of the table, they looked across at Billy.
100-8 and 4-1 they came in. "Tell him he's dead was a cert, and I've been following that crackpot all season."
Judd walked away from the table as though his loss was too great to bear standing still.
£10.
I could have had a week off work with that.
He picked the poker up and smashed it down on the fire, flushing a shower of sparks up the chimney back.
"I'd have bloody killed him if I'd have got hold of him this afternoon."
"Well, what's he crying about then?" asked Mum.
"Because he's killed my orc instead, that's why."
Judd continued to broddle in the fire.
"You have, haven't you, Judd? All right then, so I've killed it. What are you going to do about it?"
Billy rushed round the table to his mother and tried to bury his face in her. She held him off, embarrassed.
"Gee over then, Billy. Don't be so daft." "It were its own stupid fault," said Judd. "I were only going to let it go, but it won't get out of the hut. It kept lashing out at my hands with its claws. Look at them. They're scratched to ribbons."
Judd held them out for inspection. Billy ran at him, aiming straight between them. Judd raised the poker, then pushed him away with his other hand.
"You bastard! You big, rotten bastard!"
Billy stood his ground, then turned at the cuff from his mother.
"Shut up, Billy! I'm not having that kind of language in here." "Well, do summat then. Do summat to him."
She just stood there, looking over him at Judd.
"Where is it, Judd? What you done with it?"
Judd turned away to the fireplace and replaced the poker flat in the hearth. "It's in bin." Billy broke from between them, out through the kitchen to the dustbin at the side of the garage. It was black inside, so he reached down, fingers feeling lightly amongst the rubbish. Then he stopped feeling and straightened up quickly, holding the hawk in his hand. Brown eyes, open. Glass eyes. Curved beak ajar, tongue just visible in the slit. Head lolling downwards, swinging whichever way he turned it to brush away the dust and ashes from the feathers. Blowing the feathers clean, raising them with his breath, then smoothing them gently into place with his fingers. He opened one wing like a fan, and on the underside of it, slowly drew a finger down the primaries, down to the body, as though the wing was a feathered instrument, its note too soft for human hearing. He refolded the wing carefully across its back, then carried it through to the living room. Judd was standing with his back to the fire. His mother was standing at the table pouring tea.
The comic was still on the floor. "Look what it's done, ma'am. Look at it." He held the hawk out to her across the table, yellow legs upwards, Jessie's dangling, its claws, hooks in the air. "I know. It's a shame, love. But I don't want it." She sat down, bringing her face on a level with the hawk. "Look at it, though. Look what it's done." She looked at it, curling her top lip, then turned to Judd. "It were a rotten trick, Judd."
"It were a rotten trick what he did, wasn't it?" said Judd.
"I know. But you know how much he thought about that bird."
"Wasn't worth 10 quid, were it?"
Billy tried to get close to her with the bird, but she wouldn't let him. "Take it away from my face then, Billy. I've seen it."
"It's not fair on him, ma'am. It's not fair."
"Oh, shut up now then. You've cried long enough about it."
"You're not bothered about all you."
"Course I'm bothered," said Mum. "But it's only a bird. You can get another, can't you?"
She looked down at her magazine and raised her cup. Billy clenched his free hand and swung at it, fisting it clean off its handle across the room, shooting out a tongue of tea. Before Judd had time to turn or step aside, both cup and tea hit him smack between the shoulder blades. Mrs. Casper was left looking at the lug crooked on her finger. Billy followed the tea and the cup onto Judd's back, grasping him round the neck with both arms. Mrs. Casper jumped up and tried to drag him off. He kicked out at her like a hare, and she doubled up back into the table holding her breasts. The pot wobbled. The milk bottle rolled off the table and smashed. They both went for him. Billy stood up, and holding the hawk by the feet, swung it at them. Its wings opened, and the open eyes and the rush of feathers before their faces halted them long enough for Billy to hurdle the upturned settee and dart out between them, banging both doors behind him. Billy was panting hard, but he didn't stop to rest, but continued to walk slowly down the middle of the road. A row of derelict houses, and next to them, standing back from the road, a derelict cinema. Billy glanced at it as he passed, then stopped and turned back and stood before it. The palace. The arabesque lettering still visible in the plaster above the doorway. The whole facade had been finished in plaster, the pillars fluted, but these, like other areas of the facade, were peeling, revealing the same brick foundation. The forthcoming attractions board advertised nothing. An expanding gate barred the entrance, but failed to cover the upper curve of the doorway, and in the foyer behind the gate lay half bricks and stones which had been lobbed over at the boarded doors and paybox. The window was 1 foot square, covered by a sheet of zinc gauze. Billy lifted a brick and punched a hole straight through. The catch was easy, and the window opened stiffly back against the broken boards. He stuck his head in, a black square. Then, right arm through, hooking onto the upper wall inside and pulling his head through. Left arm through, body rotating, head down, stomach pressing into the sill. Pushing off the sill, hands on the floor, stomach on the sink, forward roll, shins on the sink, and stand up. His breath was loud in the dark. He struck a match. A moment while it flared, then two urinals. A toilet in the doorless cubicle, and the sink without a tap. Two steps up to the door, then the match had to be dropped. He bent and peered about the floor, found a sheet of newspaper, twisted it into a torch, and lit it from a fresh match. The foyer. Opposite him, at the far side, the corresponding door and balcony stairs. The air was damp and reeked of cat piss. Double doors leading into the stalls. The two partitions were still in place across the back, but when he stepped between them, there was no back row at the other side. There were no rows at all, just bare boards sloping down to the front. A few seat cushions and backs had been thrown into a pile against one wall. Their plush covers were ripped, and some of them had their fillings hanging out. Billy kicked one of the cushions, then dragged it up to the back. He shoved it up against the partition and sat on it, his back resting against the wood. Black, the silence ringing, intensified by the faint hum of distant traffic.
Billy shivered and pulled his jacket about him. The warmth of the pictures. The pictures full. Billy between his dad and another man. Tiny between them. A bag of sweets down between his thighs. Whispering questions up to his dad. His dad leaning down to answer them. An ice cream. An ice cream for his dad. The end. Holding on to his dad's jacket in the crowd, up the aisle and in the foyer. Down the avenue. Uncle Mick's car outside. Judd inside it, playing at the wheel. Stop here, Billy. His dad down the path. Billy after him, catching him through the kitchen door. Light flicking on in the living room. His mother and Uncle Mick jumping up off the settee, staring and flushed. The flesh under his Uncle Mick's eye splitting as easily as a tangerine. The blood streaming out. In bed. The shouting coming up through the boards. Billy crying in the dark. Judd listening. Footsteps on the landing. Billy running to the door. His dad on the landing with a case. Where you going, Dad? Go back to bed, Billy. Where are you going? I'll not be long. Judd behind him. He's leaving home. He's not. He's not. The pictures. Warm. Full. Smoky. Billy as hero. Kez on his arm. A close-up. Technicolor. Looking round. Looking down on them all. Fierce-eyed. Audience murmuring. Billy in the audience. Looking round at them all. Proud. Billy and Kez on more edge. More stretching away. Billy casting Kez off. Flying low, one rapid wide circuit, then gaining height, hovering and sliding sideways a few yards, then ringing up to her pitch and waiting on while Billy walks forward. Judd breaks from cover, running hard through the heather. Kez sees him and stoops, breathtaking stoop, audience gasps. Billy jumped up and blundered his way between the partitions, banged through the double doors, and felt up the wall for the toilet door. He climbed into the sink, squeezed out of the window feet first, then ran across the forecourt onto the pavement. He looked round at the palace, then turned away from it and shuddered. Somebody walking over his grave. It had stopped raining. The clouds were breaking up, and stars showed in the spaces between them. Billy stood for a while, glancing up and down the city road. Then he started to walk back the way he had come. When he arrived home, there was no one in. He buried the hawk in the field just behind the shed, went in, and went to bed.